day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Conference on Energy and Water Collisions in Alabama and Georgia. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode, but later today we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If you should require assistance during today's conference, you may press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone to speak with an operator. And, as a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. Now, I would like to introduce our host for today's conference, Ula Reeves.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Ula Reeves. I'm the Regional Program Director for Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. And first, I'd like to thank everyone for joining us today. I appreciate the turnout. And to get started, I'll just give a brief overview of why we are here. This morning, the River Network is releasing a report that gives a snapshot of how water is used for electrical production across the country. The Southeast is not alone. Freshwater supplies are heavily impacted by thermoelectric water. Above normal temperatures and continuing drought conditions this summer could make local rivers here in the Southeast too warm or too low to adequately cool power plants. If that happens, power plants may have to curtail electricity production, causing brownouts or blackouts. Decisions about who gets what water could affect electricity generation, drinking water availability, irrigation water availability, as well as the health of local rivers. The River Network report echoes the findings of a Union of Concerned Scientists report published last fall that found that the massive amount of water used by coal-fired and nuclear power plants is compromising watersheds around the country. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy helped to release this report in the Southeast, a part of our country where power plants are highly dependent on freshwater availability, and a region that historically did not need to worry so much about water issues. Conventional power plants are now stressing rivers and lakes by removing too much water or discharging extremely hot water, leading, especially in times of heat and drought, to water crunches. That's why it's becoming even more important that our utility companies like Georgia Power, the Tennessee Valley Authority, and Alabama Power shift to low water power technologies like wind turbines and solar photovoltaics that use essentially no water. The conflicts between energy and water needs are ones that we've seen before. Many of you will remember the drought of 2007 and will only worsen as the frequency of drought increases and water temperatures rise, driven in part by climate change. We're hearing more and more these days about the increasing drought conditions in our region, so we believe this conversation today is particularly timely. Southern Alliance for Clean Energy is proud to host the press conference today, and we present to you an excellent set of speakers to delve deeper into the new report and the significance of the water and energy collisions in Alabama and Georgia in particular, as well as the rest of the Southeast. First, I'd like to present to you Wendy Wilson, River Network's Rivers, Energy, and Climate Director. Wendy?
Hi, Ula. Thank you. Yes. My name again is Wendy Wilson, and I'm with River Network, which is a nationwide technical assistance organization for grassroots river and water conservation organizations. And today we have released a new report called Burning Our Rivers, the Water Footprint of Electricity, and you can find that at www.rivernetwork.org if you get a chance. And I was really very happy to be able to put this together because for the first time we were able to compare hydropower impacts, thermoelectric impacts, and those of emerging new electrical resources and try to answer the question of how do we want our electricity to be generated. And what we are seeing right now is that the way we produce electricity can threaten our water supplies, and it's already compromising our water quality across the nation. We see problems from Lake Erie to the southwest to the northwest with salmon runs to the southeast. So trying to wrap it all together into a national picture, what we discovered is that at least the year we looked at, 2009, it took on average 40,000 gallons of fresh water to produce a megawatt hour of electricity in this country, and that is water that is either used, polluted, or consumed in the process of making that electricity. And that is essentially what it takes to power one household for a month in this country. So 40,000 gallons per megawatt hour which is 5 times more than that same household would probably use for average residential use in the same month. So this is, we think, a tremendous inefficient use of water. In many cases, there's far more water-efficient ways that we can generate electricity, and there'll be a lot of co-benefits to reducing that amount of water use. For example, just phasing out fresh water use for once through cooling and increasing solar and wind power to a substantial portion of the grid, like 40%, just on our simple calculations, would provide an 80% savings of thermoelectric water use. And that would be a lot more water to talk about. And I think a lot of this is that we're bringing up today is really to start the discussion at the local level. There is not a strong process of evaluating the energy return for water invested in the technologies that we're using to produce electricity today. And so we're trying to put this out there so that communities can start looking at the local impacts of how electricity is affecting their water supply and their water quality. And that's where the most important decisions have to be made right now. So I'm really glad to be here today. If there are specific questions about the report, again, that's at www.rivernetwork.org, and it's called Burning Our Rivers, the Water Footprint of Electricity.
Great. Thank you, Wendy. And next we have Todd Rasmussen, hydrology professor at the University of Georgia.
Thank you, Ula. I'd like to first provide a quick update on the current drought here in the southeast, and then give some of the expected impacts if our drought continues. And unfortunately, our soils and streams are at, in many cases, below record low values for this time of year. This is much worse than last year at the same time, and actually bordering on the severe droughts of the past. And even though Tropical Storm Debby caused devastating floods to our south, our region is still experiencing below normal rainfall over at least the past year, if not longer. This lack of rainfall has caused extreme to exceptional drought conditions across much of the southeast, and our drought is predicted to get even worse through September. Last year's drought affected the agricultural sector, but this year's drought, if it continues, will start to affect water supplies for cities and power producers, as well as have impacts on our rivers, lakes, and streams. And as these flows decrease, water quality problems will begin to appear. We've already seen a number of fish kills and toxic algae blooms. There was one recently in the Atlanta area that has caused livestock mortality, as well as other fish and wildlife impacts. Because we should be prepared for the likely event of a continued drought, we should anticipate the need for strong conservation measures. I'd like to say that at one point, it's good to look at our production, but also to think of the personal impacts of water and energy conservation, how they affect our environment. Worst-case scenarios for energy and water shortages later this summer can be avoided if we take time now to prepare. This is a short-term response, and unlike a hurricane, tornado, or earthquake that strikes quickly, these droughts are disasters in slow motion. It's something that we could prepare for. As everybody knows, our electrical use soars during hot, dry summers, which means that we must ramp up our production and transmission of electric power. During recent droughts here and also in Texas, power production had to be reduced due to insufficient water to cool power plants. But generating electricity also produces large quantities of hot water, as been mentioned. When these plants discharge hot water they use back into waterways, it heats our local lakes and streams, leading to fish kills and toxic algae blooms. This means that turning off lights and setting the thermostat to a warmer setting during the summer will have substantial impacts both on energy conservation as well as water quantity and quality conservation. And water conservation means less energy to pump water. Not watering your lawn means saving energy, which leads to a double savings of water. And there's an issue here recently with our tri-state water dispute. Because of this recent Supreme Court decision declining to hear the Florida-Alabama appeal of the recent 11th Circuit Court decision, we're basically back to where we were a decade ago, with the Army Corps engineers having to develop a new operating plan for managing the operations of Lake Lanier. Whatever plan they decide upon will certainly be challenged, probably again and again, unless a regional decision is adopted. The course plan would be more viable if all parties first agreed on their water resource management goals, including energy and water. While a grassroots stakeholders process has been initiated, this is the ACF stakeholders group, they're making a positive contribution toward defining regional water priorities. The time has come for state leadership to step forward and develop the best science agreement between the states. And thank you.
Great. Thank you, Todd. Next, we have Dave Lochbaum, who is the director of the Union of Concerned Scientists Nuclear and Safety Project.
Good morning. Nuclear power plants are about 33% efficient. That means for every 3 units of energy produced by a reactor core, 1 unit of electricity is produced, and 2 units of waste heat must be rejected to the environment. That's why nuclear power plants are built next to rivers, lakes, and oceans. That water is used to carry away this waste heat. High water temperatures, low water levels, or stuff in the water itself can impede the ability of the water to carry away the waste heat. Nuclear power plants cannot continue running without means of rejecting their waste heat. Thus, when nearby water bodies cannot accept some or all of that waste heat, nuclear power plants must lower their power levels or shut down altogether. I have a few examples among many. In July of 2008, the Unit 1 reactor at the Hatch nuclear plant in Georgia had to reduce its power level due to high air and water temperatures. In May of 2008, the Unit 2 reactor at Hatch had to cut its power level in half when algae buildup on its cooling tower screens blocked cooling water flows. In January of 2008, the Unit 2 reactor at the Browns Ferry nuclear plant in Alabama had to cut its power level in half when small fish, a large amount of small fish, collected on the intake screens where river water was drawn into the plant for cooling. The fish blocked the cooling water flow, forcing the reactor power level to be reduced as a consequence. There are many other examples each year in our database where water issues have caused problems at nuclear plants in Georgia, Alabama, Florida, and many other states. Ironically, nuclear power isn't really a solution for global warming. Instead, global warming must be solved in order for nuclear power to have a future. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. And last, we have Mitch Reed, the Program Director for Alabama Rivers Alliance. Mitch?
Thank you, Ula. I guess we are the local voice in this story. These reports highlight really the challenges that we face in the Southeast and Alabama in particular as we look toward the future of water management in the Southeast. Given these reports and some of the sobering information that comes out of them, and then considering the decision by the Corps of Engineers, or I'm sorry, the Supreme Court in the water wars, and then looking to the Corps of Engineers for their decision on water allocation in the ACF, I think that we can take away from this that our water resources can no longer be taken for granted. In Alabama, currently, we don't have a water management plan that determines how all water users are going to get the water that they need, whether it's for electrical generation or if it's for irrigation, and certainly we don't have a plan for making sure that there's enough water left in the river for the protection of the system itself. The Alabama Rivers Alliance has been working with our state leaders and legislatures over the past year to try to get some traction towards adopting a comprehensive water management plan. And in April, Governor Bentley took up the flag when he directed the state agencies that deal with water to develop and provide him a recommendation for a comprehensive water management plan by 2013. This report and the information that's provided in here will go towards informing these state leaders in how we're going to develop this plan and how we're going to move forward. I think that any plan that the state comes up with is going to have to consider how we're going to use our water most effectively for the benefit of all of our water users, as well as protect the river and the system itself. And I appreciate the ability to be on this call. I'll be happy to answer any questions about this or anything else.
Great. Thank you, Mitch. And that concludes the presentation portion, and I believe we will now open up the lines for questions from reporters.
Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question is later answered, or you wish to remove yourself from the queue for any reason, you may press the pound key to do so. Once again, to ask a question, please press star, then one. One moment while participants enter the queue. Our first question comes from the line of Thomas Spencer from the Birmingham News.
Hi. I was just wondering, have we had any, what are the real problem areas in Alabama? And I mean, the release kind of suggests that we may have run the risk of brownouts this summer. Is that really a something that we could be facing if we don't get a lot of rain?
Mitch, do you want to start with a response to that?
Well, I certainly can't speak to the engineering aspects of how we're going to manage the water resources. That would probably be best given to Dave or somebody like that. I do know that particularly in the southeast, corner of the state that's been under such just massive droughts over the past year. The fact is right now we don't have any system of making sure that really that water is flowing down to the plants. One of the things that I think is the saving grace for Alabama is that our intakes are on regulated streams that are essentially managed in part by the Corps of Engineers, either above or below the intakes for the power company. I know that Farley Nuclear is you know one of the major concerns on the ACF, and it's one of the reasons that we've paid such a huge amount of attention to what's going on in the water wars in the ACF system. You know, I certainly can't speak to whether whether Farley Nuclear is facing brownout conditions because of flow on the Chattahoochee. That would have to sort of be answered by how they're controlling water out of Lanier. I know that in drought reports that we've been on, and I know that Todd's been on these as well, it's been very touch and go over the past year for the amount of water flowing into the system to make sure that minimum flows can be released throughout the system. You know, I think that we can't have this discussion about water and energy without also considering the reliance, or at least the partial reliance that we have in Alabama on our hydropower. This question of how much water we're sharing between the states, how we're managing the water. One of our huge uses of water, it's not necessarily consumptive as far as people taking water out of the system, is how much we're storing for the hydropower reservoirs in the system. And then, you know, I think continuing that thought further, we have to consider how much water we're losing in order to sort of store that water up for the peak flows. And so I think it fits into it, although I would punt the question of actual brownouts to someone in an engineering field.
Wendy or Dave care to respond?
This is Dave. I can take a shot at it. The challenge that the plants face is that it's a common threat to all of them. 10 years ago, California faced some brownouts in part because a large part of the San Onofre nuclear power plant broke and took several months to repair. So that plant was out of service at a time when electricity supply was thin. So there were some rolling brownouts and blackouts as a result. The concern here is a little bit more widespread because high water temperatures affect all three plants at Browns Ferry, for example. Even if the powers that be gave a dispensation allowed the plant to continue running as the water temperature went up and up, the plant's simply not designed to handle it. The Hatch plant in Georgia had to shut down or reduce power in the past because some of the systems used to clean up the water that goes through the reactor core literally melted at 140 degrees Fahrenheit. When the water temperature approaches 95 degrees in the river, it's difficult for cooling water inside the plant to be low enough to allow equipment to continue running. So the threat is so widespread that it doesn't take one reactor out at Browns Ferry, one reactor out at Hatch, or one reactor out at Farley. It represents a threat that could take all of them off the table or at reduced power level at a time when high temperatures put a high demand for electricity. So it's a perverse situation where as the temperatures goes up, the demand for electricity goes up, the ability of the generators to supply it goes down. So that's the threat. I can't project where that, how bad that will get this summer or next summer, but that's the challenge that the people face.
This is Todd Rasmussen. If I could just add on to this, a recent study just came out of the University of Kentucky looking at tree ring data, reconstruct climate signatures back to 1600, and they're showing over the last 400 years there have been extremely severe droughts, much worse than anything we've had recently. And so in preparing for these things, I think in terms of the design, I don't know that we really have the resiliency or robustness to prepare for the droughts that have been observed in the past.
Great. Thank you all. Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Brian Lawson from the Huntsville Times.
Hey, I guess this question's for Dave, but I'd be glad to hear from anybody else as well. When we talk about the river temperature near Browns Ferry, and I know if it gets above, I guess it's 90 degrees, they're asked to scale back because of the intake and what that does to the plant. I wonder if you think that's a good level to set it at, or does it need to go lower?
That's from the studies I've seen, that's an acceptable level. It's a good balance between what the plant needs and what the aquatic wildlife in the area needs. So I don't see any reason to adjust it up or down for that matter.
Thank you.
Next question.
Our next question comes from the line of Julia Piper from ClimateWire.
Hi there. You mentioned that some of the solutions to this are to look to more renewable energy. What can be done? You know, those types of projects take a long time to build up and probably get to the capacity we'd need. What can be done in the interim? And I guess maybe specifically what could be done in Alabama, things that they might be looking to include in their plan to address the issue right away?
This is Ula Reeves with Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. I can take a quick stab at that. You know, one of the things that we are seeing that really needs to happen, particularly in Georgia and Alabama, is for the power companies to decrease the number of coal plants that are operating. So many of these coal plants are extremely old and inefficient anyway, and the water component and issues that we're discussing today are just one factor of many. And, you know, I actually, you know, upscaling on photovoltaics and intertwining that with aggressive energy efficiency programs actually, you know, can come in and begin to meet some of the needs, not necessarily at the same scale at the exact same time, but we're seeing many other utilities in the Southeast, in the Duke and Progress energy system, and even the Tennessee Valley Authority making commitments to begin to look forward to retire coal plants, take them offline and replace some with natural gas, and also increasing efficiency programs and other sources. So I think it's a combination of factors. And, you know, as somebody has already mentioned, the drought issues are ones that we can actually see coming to a certain extent, and this is all in relative slow motion. I think we anticipate that these challenges of water uncertainty in the Southeast are only going to increase, and we need forward-thinking approaches from the utility companies to see that, you know, water for power plants is not the first priority. It can't be the only priority. There are so many other needs for water, drinking water, and obviously the ecosystem health and agriculture just become such competing demands. So, you know, I think it's a mix of responses that we need to see. Some of the natural gas facilities that are coming online in other utility systems to replace coal plants can be less water intensive, not always. So I think, you know, water's an issue no matter what the power plant is, but some are better than others.
Okay.
If I could follow up on that, there's some studies that show that 30% of our electrical demand is for lighting, But with conversion to low-energy light sources like LED, even beyond the compact fluorescent devices, could substantially reduce our electrical demand, which in turn saves tremendous amounts of water. So I think conservation, both in terms of behavior of accepting warmer temperatures in the home, as well as less irrigation on the outside of the house during droughts, would both be short-term methods that could be used to reduce our impact.
Sorry, who is that speaking?
This is Todd Rasmussen.
Okay, great. Thanks. Sorry.
And this is Mitch Reed. If I can sort of address the movement here in Alabama to try to adopt a water management plan, I think that Todd hit some of the keys in what he just said, is that efficiency in our water use and making sure that we are not wasting water, or, you know, wasting water or wasting electricity, which in turn uses more water, has got to be addressed as part of a comprehensive plan, and also the bare conservation of water, making sure that that we don't just use water as a, you know, as to spill it on the ground, so to speak. One of the things that I think we see is that, you know, currently our models for water use are based off of use as much as you can, and that's how we, you know, fund water infrastructure projects and things like that. And so one of the things that could be part of a comprehensive plan would be setting up a system where we incentivize people to use less water, and that would in turn use less energy to treat and pump and move that water. And then if we could also sort of get our head around, if we use less electricity, we will therefore, you know, be less vulnerable to the times of drought and to the whims of nature. You know, that would go a long way to providing more security for this. But I mean, without a plan at the state level in Alabama, it's hard to even have this conversation. That's why the first cornerstone of sort of getting into this conversation is the actions that I think Governor Bentley is going down, is to try to develop what that plan would look like.
And this is Wendy Wilson with River Network. I think that's one of the important reasons we're having this press conference today, Julia, is because at least at the national level, I'm not sure that we know the answer to the question. You know, is someone managing the farm here on our integrating our water and energy needs, or, you know, are we just praying for rain? It's not clear that the water and the energy agencies are in a process where they are talking about these scenarios and building the resilience that we need to face these kind of challenges. And what's happening in Georgia, when Mitch says we need a comprehensive water plan, that is not nearly as boring as it sounds. It's very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Right, so this can span out to the national level also.
This is Todd Rasmussen. One of our former state climatologists said Rome is burning and Nero is fiddling.
All right, well, thank you.
Thank you. And one last thing, this is Ula. I would just flag, too, that the you know, many of the coal-fired power plants, in particular in the southeast, are using once-through cooling systems, which are, you know, bigger water drinkers than the recirculating cooling, and it's not necessarily making. I mean, there is a case to be made for switching certain facilities to lower water technology. In that case, our Southern Alliance for Clean Energy would like to see less coal plants in general, because we think that there are so many needs for a cleaner energy future beyond coal. But once through cooling plants were designed and utilized in the southeast because, as we've mentioned, historically water availability was historically just much greater than it is, than I think we're anticipating in the future. And so that's something to consider, that if a facility is worth keeping alive, then, you know, what else can be done to maximize water efficiency?
Okay, thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Josephine Bennett from Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Hi. Considering current hydrological data in Georgia, what plants might be most at risk, and can you speak specifically to water supplies for Plant Vogel and also the proposed Plant Washington coal plant up in Sandersville?
I'll let Dave handle the Vogel question, and I can respond a little bit to Plant Washington. This is Ula. Dave, do you want to go first?
I really don't have much. I haven't looked at the Vogel situation, so I really don't have much to address that specific instance.
This is Todd Rasmussen. The Savannah is nearing record lows. They've been looking at water management issues for the last decade on the river, trying to meet environmental objectives. There is a real concern about low flows on the river. Plant Washington would like to be able to go to groundwater during severe droughts. There are still questions about whether there's sufficient groundwater and what those impacts would be on wetlands around the region to switch to groundwater during severe droughts. So these are all scenarios that are being examined, and there's a risk there. One of the big issues is that they do have large resources, like large reservoirs, but even with large reservoirs, they still can't meet the needs of all the users, whether it be agriculture, power, or urban centers, or even the Savannah Harbor deepening project that's being proposed all at the same time. So we have a crisis in management. I think we have the monster computer on our desktop, but we don't have the operating system to run these resources. So building more reservoirs when we can't manage our existing reservoirs is perhaps not the best solution.
Yeah, and this is Ula Reeves. And on Plant Washington, we did an analysis with some of our local water group partners just a couple weeks ago to look at if the plant existed today, would the water be there to provide what Plant Washington would need? And we concluded that every day in May, Power for Georgians would have had to have relied on its Plan B, which, as Todd mentioned, would be to tap groundwater because the Oconee River has been running so low this year. And we issued a press release on June 4th, and I'd be happy to get that to you if you're interested in digging a little bit deeper into that particular story.
But just to follow up, is there hydrological data for that groundwater around plant, you know, the proposed groundwater and wells they would pull from?
Yes, I believe so.
Because I actually had done so. I hadn't been able to find anything on it to see if it was sufficient.
Yes, I believe so. I'd be happy to talk with you offline and put you in touch with some of the folks who have more of the details at their fingertips.
Okay.
And this was Josephine?
Yes, ma'am.
With, I'm sorry, your outlet again?
Georgia Public Broadcasting.
Great. Okay.
Our next question comes from the line of Dennis Scherer from Times Daily.
Hey, how are y'all doing? Actually got two questions. First is on the power side, a lot of questions that people are going to have for the Egregious Story is what would it cost to move away from some of these more water-intensive methods for producing electricity and going to the solar photovoltaics and wind, et cetera?
Well, Dennis, this is Ula Reeves. Again, we could chat offline. I think the cost issues are, exist whatever way we look at saving water. So whether it's going to recirculating cooling towers so that a particular power plant is more efficient, or switching over to PV and wind, but my understanding and my colleagues in my organization have a greater depth of knowledge on the very specific cost ratios, but my understanding is that the costs are significantly decreasing compared to traditional coal and nuclear, and that we're starting to see not necessarily grid parity, but seeing that these alternative resources that are less water intensive are becoming much more affordable and realistic options for our utility companies to seriously consider.
And this is Wendy with River Network again. And another question is, what are the costs to the society, to our society, for not making those investments, and how much would it cost our energy producers to actually pay for water? Because if they had to pay for 40,000 gallons per megawatt hour, I think the economics of the production facilities would look different as well.
Yeah, and I guess along those lines, the other thing I would add there is that, you know, for instance, in North Carolina, Duke Energy owns so much of the water that they're using for their power plants that they are the first and most important user. They control the decisions about the water, and, you know, looking at water resource needs from a holistic perspective, from what society needs, I don't think that it, you know, it's certainly not a fair division of who gets to make these choices. If the power plants are the very, very, and the power providers are the very last ones who are making decisions to conserve, then that puts all of the burden on the citizens, the agricultural users, recreational use, and Mother Nature bats last and gets the last drop of water. So I think Wendy's exactly right, that we have to take other costs into consideration when we're thinking about how to resolve these problems.
Or at least have a forum for making those kind of investment decisions. And also, energy conservation in this context is water conservation, and how we incentivize and monetize energy conservation and bundle that into demand control is also an important tool.
Was there a second question there?
Sorry?
I believe the speaker had a second question.
Oh, okay. Dennis, did you have something else for us?
I believe Dennis's line has disconnected.
Okay.
And we're just answering his questions, and he's already gone.
Our next question comes from the line of Josephine Bennett.
Oh, I already had my question answered.
Well, if I could follow up on that cost question just for other listeners, that we've been wrestling with water rate structures, and one of the most expensive parts of our infrastructure is meeting peak demands, whether it's peak electrical or peak water demands. And the question during these extreme events, they may not be very frequent, but yet they drive up the cost of production enormously to have that capacity on hand so little percentage of the time. And so shifting the peak somehow and moving more of the demand to off-peak times would be extremely helpful. It'd be like highways. They're fine in the middle of the night, but during gridlock, it's a mess. And so widening our lanes to 23 lane, our highways to 23 lanes is very expensive to meet those few hours. And so a policy that somehow evened out the load that would provide incentives for storage of water and power, and essentially during the hot, dry summers here when photovoltaics would be most efficient, would be aligned with when our greatest cooling requirements are. So I think there are win-win opportunities that could actually reduce the cost of power if we were to manage it properly.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you wish to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone telephone. At this time, I see no further questions in the queue.
Okay. Well, we can wrap up. And again, this is Ulla Reeves, and I'd like to encourage everybody to follow up with me if you have further questions. If you have the media advisory, which I assume you do, you've got further contact information for several of us, and we'd be happy to get you in touch with other speakers or put you in the right direction for other allies and colleagues of ours who may have more detail. And thank you so much to our speakers and to our participants for joining us today. I know everyone's very busy, but obviously these are extremely important issues and will continue to be so throughout the summer. And I hope we can continue to be a resource for you. Well, thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Ula.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attendance on today's conference. This does conclude today's program.
Thank you.
And you may now disconnect.